Hello, everyone. This is episode 46 of the Dresden Files podcast, member of the Broken Jars Network. And today we're talking about not Dresden Files. How confusing. But since we don't really have any news, the one thing we kind of have new is that we kind of got a sponsorship from Zencastr, which is why the quality of our audio might have gone up. And if not, I'm just going to be very angry at them because I had to do this ad.
Unless you're watching us on YouTube, in which case, no difference.
I don't. Right. Yeah, I guess it wouldn't be a difference.
We're not getting the new audio there.
But it's supposed to help. And if not, then I'm going to blame Jacob. And Zencastr is giving us stuff for free. And
Jacob,
they can
fired.
Give you some stuff for free if you go to them and use a Broken Jars, I think, is the tag that you need for the code in order to get a month or two free of their stuff. So go check that out if you want. But yeah, the Dresden Files podcast is going like Dresden adjacent and talking about Cinder Spires today, specifically the only
like
book we have.
The Butcher podcast.
Shh.
We're expanding.
We're not Swinless. Maybe when we get a second book, we might have to start up a sister podcast of just Cinder Spires. I don't know.
We can just rename to the Jim Butcher pedo. No, that's not the right word. What's the when you're like a maniac about something?
File?
Fanatic.
What's the word? Fanatic. That's the word I was looking
fanatic.
For. I was about to say pedophile, which is a very different thing.
That's way worse. And just make sure you never associate his name with that word, and we're good.
Yeah, no.
And yet it's already out there. All right. So the general rundown of Aeronauts Windless, the first and at the moment only book of Cinder Spires series, is there's a bunch of spires and there's a bunch of people, and we're kind of centered on Spire Albion. And Spire Aurora has attacked.
The one true great Spire. Albion.
Yeah.
Well, ish. Yeah. Do you want the other behind the scenes stuff since we're going to talk about all the behind the scenes and the possibilities and the linkages?
Yeah, just at the moment. We're going to spoil absolutely everything, both Dresden and Cinder Spires. So if you haven't read this book, turn it off now.
Oh, spoiler and probably sometimes Codex Alera. So to get all that out there.
It is the
so picture. I think it's important in case you hadn't made the linkages and you're not a history buff, but I think this specifically takes place in the rise of Albion versus the Aurorans, which pretty almost directly mirrors the rise of the British Empire versus the Spanish Armada. So they're talking about the Auroran Armada and Albion. Albion was another word for London or another word for the UK or something like that, if I remember right.
Albion,
and I'm not sure
like
the linkage on Aurora.
Where Arthur is buried and stuff? Like, I think.
I thought.
So something. There's something there in Arthurian lore with Albion.
No, apparently Albion is the oldest known name of the island of Great Britain.
There you go. Yeah.
I'm sure there's something more.
I think you're thinking Avalon is Arthur's.
That is exactly what I'm thinking about.
Yeah.
Okay.
But I think it's important to know because if you know your history, you probably know about how this story's going to go, but then hopefully you're going to know about how the next couple of stories go, hopefully, if it is, you know, if he does lift it directly. But anyway.
Which he might not, so maybe you could hopefully know something and then be completely surprised. But yeah, Albion does seem to be very British cultured. They're very insistent on tea. One of our main characters' last name is Lancaster. Very like houses, very proper and things. But Aurorans do seem to have like Latin based names, more like Spanish Latin based, that I think. But we don't really know if they're Spanish or just Latin or maybe even Italian. I don't know. I wouldn't put money on Italian, but. Eh.
I say Spanish, but that's just me.
I say Spanish, too, but I just think he could be surprising us in some fashion, but I bet Spanish.
Conquistador vibe, you know? That's Spanish, right?
Yeah. Well, we're going to get into the characters, and we can talk about their backgrounds and cultures and stuff. And I'm going to start with Gwen, which the first line of Cinder Spires is her full name and as she does something, but her full name is interesting because it's Gwendolyn Margaret Elizabeth Lancaster. And first of those two names are very interesting in Dresden Files because Harry's mother was Margaret Gwendolyn Le Fay. He used both of them because he forgot there are other names out there in the universe.
Yeah.
I'm thinking this is just a reference to the Dresden Files, not a
Or there's something else we don't know. But it's just like very particular. He emphasizes so often that names are important. Why did he reuse those two names? On one character, even, not even just like splitting them up between random people.
Right. She's gonna die. Maybe Gwen is living vicariously for, you know, the fact that we're never going to see Harry's mom, right, in action. So watch Gwen and see all the shenanigans she gets up to and probably her personality. I would imagine where she's just like, I want to do the right thing. Sometimes that means shooting this guy in the face. Okay.
Yeah. She's very bullheaded. She's also apparently really small and looks like a porcelain doll. Although I have never seen a description of her hair color, which seemed weird because I assumed that she looks like Murphy. And then it's like, wait, I don't actually know that she's blonde.
I imagine like long brown hair. I don't know why.
Right. So I think there was, I had the same thing, and it's supposed to be like brown hair, actually. Like, I think Jim has tweeted some stuff, or he's come out and basically said, like, this is pretty much the kind of hair that she would have or whatever. Kind of like he did with Mouse and everything, where it's like you never get a super good picture of Mouse, and then he'll tweet something and be like, see this giant dog and that tiny man? That's what Mouse looks like. So I think he's done that with Gwendolyn, and it was a brownish. But I always pictured her as blonde as well. So I don't know, maybe we've got something going on there.
Well, she is supposed to be tiny and just like a force to be reckoned with regardless. Well, even people who aren't all that tall, like Grimm, he's like supposed to be like 5'9", 5'10", I'm guessing, because he's like not the tallest. He's just very average, middling height, and she's still tiny compared to him. So I figure she's Murphy-sized.
Okay, sure. I mean, she's a little below average for a woman.
Yeah, and it doesn't help that she's constantly next to her cousin Benedict, who is supposed to be really tall.
Right.
Mm-hmm. But about names that just became very interesting on the reread, it's like, why is he using those names? Is the name Aster is used for another house of Albion. They're kind of just like assholes, I guess. They're not really the antagonists until they just like start being giant dickheads. But the name Aster comes up in Dresden Files as Faith Aster, who the one who kind of started it all with Harry and having to find her, and she ran away from her parents, and she's going to come back and kick off the BAT somehow. So why did he use that name too?
Right. I think, I mean, really the Asters are a drop-in of the rich assholes, and without going the full story arc of Harry Potter, they're an analog for the Malfoys in a way, like early on. They're meddlesome, they're rich, they're dicks, and then, you know, maybe they'll be tied to the Dark Lords, who knows, but right now, you know, it's enough for book one to know that they're assholes and they're rich, and the Astors were... The Asters were rich assholes in Restoration of Faith because she ran away because her parents had a kid just to have a kid. She was a trophy child. Mm-hmm. Real people don't do that. Assholes do that. Monsters do that. But like, you know, I just... So anyway, so we know that the Asters in A Restoration of Faith were rich assholes because she threatened multiple times that they were going to tell the cops, they were going to lie. They offered this huge windfall for Harry and his partner, and then pulled the rug out from under them and pulled the whole who are you going to trust, who are you going to believe type of thing. So anyway.
Yes, the Asters are just kind of rich assholes, but I wouldn't say that the analogy to them being like the Malfoys is accurate, because I think that's going to be reserved for Rook, and we'll get to him in a bit.
Maybe. Yeah, it's a good point.
Yeah. Well, I mean, I guess we get to him a little bit right now, and the fact that we're going to talk about Captain Grimm next. His name is Captain Francis Madison Grimm, and he doesn't like being called Francis. He likes being called Mad, after the shortening of his middle name. But why does he like that name?
Because Malcolm Reynolds. Seriously, he's like Harry Dresden and Malcolm Reynolds had a baby. He's a privateer in a pirate ship. He goes by Mad instead of Mal. He's 5'10" because he's somewhat the opposite of Harry, and that's where he gets his influences from there, because he's never without his hat, because A, it's practical, but really it's because you know, Jim Butcher wanted a guy who always had a hat, whereas Dresden never has a hat, right? Mm-hmm. So
I'm never going to forgive Jim.
So yeah, I mean, that the hat and the goggles and everything is explained in World and Practical, but yeah, especially the whole Mad thing, I'm like, yeah, well, because Mal was taken, so we had to give him another thing, like, you know. And it strikes terror. It's a scary name, right? Pirate.
But then his name is essentially Mad Grim. How dark can you get for one person's name? But then there's another thing from Justin Files of Thomas's cousins that were Madeline and Magical, both of which went by Mad.
Yeah, I like Grimm, but I don't think he's a white court. Like, you know, you don't see any dudes tripping over him. So
that's why it raises questions. Why did he choose that name when he's already used it before?
With something like Mad, you can have it be more than one thing. So instead of being Madeline and Madrigal, who are nuts, part of Mad, you've got Mad Grimm, who is like the angry kind of mad, right? Welcome to the English language. I'm reaching, but it's something to go with.
He just, it works for him, but he went much more heavy-handed with this character's name than he usually does. Like, it works in ways that I'm surprised how much I liked it, but the fact that the Ethrealists call him the Grim Captain instead of Captain Grimm, it still works.
But they always get things out of order, right? So, I'm going to meet you tomorrow. So, wait, what?
Yeah,
that's great. I also like the fact that he's Francis, because that works in a bunch of Deadpool references, which I think this came out before Deadpool, right? But now we could be like, come on, Francis, you know, the whole time. It's like, my name is Grimm. Anyway.
House of Cards has been around longer than this book has, I think.
Yes.
Are you saying that it's taking something from House of Cards?
Yeah, maybe Frank Underwood's name is actually Francis Underwood.
Okay.
I don't think it's a deliberate reference, but I mean, he has been influenced by watching TV shows before.
Oh, yeah.
That's funny.
So
maybe he was just sitting there, writing, watching House of Cards. What's this guy going to be called?
It's possible. But Grimm, he's a fun character. He's an interesting backstory in the fact that he's very much the military guy that got kicked out of the fleet because the way he describes it, he did his duty. And how everyone else describes it is he ran away as a coward in the face of the enemy.
I get the impression
and we don't know
that he saved his crew, basically.
Yeah, we don't know the exact details yet. They're just kind of dangling it in front of us. It's like, please tell me,
goddammit. What we've seen of the character, he did something that was honorable.
Mm-hmm.
Right. Well,
maybe against orders, but he did the right thing.
Well, and specifically, Baird probably helped him, but for whatever reason, Rook and Baird were spared, and somebody had to bite the bullet. And it's possible that Grimm volunteered to do it because he was going to spare the other two, even though Rook almost certainly was the deserving party for being drummed out. It could have been 100 things. I mean, it could have been because Rook is from a more influential family. It almost certainly was or could have been from just Grimm's sense of duty and things like that as well. But Grimm is like case in point for you can take the boy out of fleet, but you can't take fleet out of the boy. Mm-hmm. And, you know, like to the point where even Creedy, who is more or less on his XO is more or less on what's the word that I'm looking for? He's suspended temporarily, and that's why he's on Grimm's ship, because everybody's still, like, anybody who knows what actually happened knows that Grimm doesn't deserve the treatment that he's gotten. And so they send promising officers to Grimm because they know that he'll treat them right, and he knows what the drill is. That's kind of the impression I got.
Well, Creedy is working with Grimm because Creedy's sister asked a favor, which we've never met Creedy's sister.
Okay, I got you.
But
was it Creedy's sister? Okay.
So the little bit we know of the incident that got Grimm kicked out of the fleet is that Grimm, his friend Baird, and Commodore Hamilton Rook, he wasn't a Commodore at the time, they were all on the ship called the Perilous. And something happened. The commanding officer was killed. The XO was unconscious and in a coma. And the ship came back alive. Presumably, Grimm took command, even though he shouldn't have, and then he got kicked out.
Right. But specifically drummed out for being a coward, which is, like, the worst kind of kicked out. Yeah. Well, yeah. And I mean, if you've read the book, it comes up multiple times. You know, Gwen picks up on it. Multiple other people pick up on it and be like, so you're the complete opposite of a coward. You know that, right? And he just kind of looks at him like, uh-huh. You know, and then they go on with life, because Predator, part of why it's important to the story and what happens early on is that they get attacked by one of the most famous warships of all time with a 500-year running history because of how effective he is as a privateer. So, I mean, even knowing that, how could you cite the guy as a coward unless you decide that privateers are cowards for targeting merchant ships? But it's, you know, for the times especially, it's definitely a aspect of their warfare.
Yeah. And since that time, Hamilton Rook ascended the ranks rather fast and happily, and his family is buying up all the crystals like they can, because the houses are, of course, vying for power. So when Predator gets injured in the beginning, Rook comes up and like says, oh, so you're going to sell me the ship, right? Okay, I'll double the offer. Sell me the ship already. Because, like, of course, I'm powerful. You got to take it. And then Grimm just slaps him.
Right, but he also threatens to take it through courts. Yes. Basically, he could force it away from Grimm.
That slap, by the way, is the most satisfying slap I've ever experienced with a character I've known that, like, short time.
Right.
Like, he's just instantly very dislikable.
Yeah, he does pretty good with the instant dislike characters if he wants to. And so that slap is just like, yay. And then also kind of foreboding. It's like, aren't you going to get in a shit ton of trouble for that? Which was great. And he probably will, eventually. Something like that's got to come back and bite him in the ass.
But with the events at the end of the book, we don't know how that's going to affect Rook. And, I mean, we kind of know he's going to get away with it. But still, like, the evidence is going to mount eventually, mm-hmm. You know.
But Rook is going to have much more of a personal vendetta than he already previously had against Grimm.
Sure.
And so that he's probably going to be an antagonist. And this is an interesting connection with Rook and Codex Alera, because one, the name Rook is used in Codex Alera once, and it's kind of a spy character. It's a woman, and she uses her water magic in order to illusion herself into a different characters or various ones. And she's at the slavery employ, to Kellaris Brensis. And Brensis is so much of an asshole that he's very much the traitor, and he destroys a lot of things in Codex Alera. And Rook's kind of has the same feel for him, that he's going to be a problem, even though he's supposed to be on the same side.
I mean, I don't know if I think he's going to be a problem. I think he's a douchebag, and maybe. I don't know. I mean, I don't think he's, like, against Spire Albion or anything. He's just, like, an asshole.
No, he's just for himself and for his family.
Right. So the...
Which is... Their success is tied to Spire Albion, though. Like, they are...
What the risk is, though, is that Albion. He could be bought, is the point. You know, so... Mm-hmm. So yeah. You're right in the sense that they could be Malfoys, in the sense that they're one of the high houses, they're rich, they're trying to get power. If somebody promises them the right thing, then
also, he is an outright coward. And when he showed up to help in the last part of the book, and then his ship gets fired upon, they could have fought it out if he stayed, but no, he turned tail and ran.
He is the coward.
Right.
He was like, oh shit, we took some amount of damage, retreat!
Yeah, so Grimm says that he was a coward in the face of the enemy, and he said so in a written report. And Rook says that, well, no, the damage was actually catastrophic to a certain lift crystal, so they had to turn tail and hide because they couldn't fight back or something like that.
They temporarily lost control, and that was the part that bothered me, was like, okay, well, if it's temporary, then get your ass back in the fight. So that's how
it was over when we fixed it.
Yeah, right, like, if right? That kind of damage, yes, that he described should be evident afterwards. They should be able to investigate that.
Right.
But then the only other person,
they trust his word.
Yeah, because of his family. And the only other person that was kind of involved in order to give a report was Bayard again. And as he's coming at a certain angle in that fight, he couldn't see close enough what actually happened, so he couldn't put his word against any of the others. And it's just kind of this ongoing issue between the three of them. Although Bayard's a good guy, even though he's really short.
Bayard's a good guy, but I also feel like there was a certain amount of not sticking his neck out going on there, because it's going to be the Perilous Incident all over again, right? It's going to be Bayard and Grimm versus Rook, and we already know how that went, so it just went the same way again, where Rook got away with it and Grimm
got stuck holding it. That I think you're right, that I think Grimm kind of volunteered, because as he said to Bayard in the beginning, is like, he took it so Bayard didn't have to. And this time, Grimm has the Spire Arc on his side.
Ish, for whatever that's worth.
And on the internal side. So the public documents are going to smear him, but the person who's actually in power is actually the one on his side.
Well, except that he's not actually in power. Yeah, he's a figurehead.
Yeah, he's such a puppet. He just knows how to send people to the right area at the right time.
The joke about what that's worth would be, you know, one of those Mark IV lift crystals that should belong in a battle cruiser instead being in a destroyer, and then, you know, the associated trim and lift crystals for, you know, the incidentals and things like that. So, I mean, it's certainly worth something, but as far as, like, the political game, he's more or less a figurehead, you know?
I'm sure he has pull, and it seems like he's kind of got this, like, this almost spy master thing going on.
Mm-hmm. I think he's got money as much as anything.
Yeah. So, but I don't think
he's the intelligence to use it correctly.
Right. He doesn't have the like political power or like just straight up just like monarchy. Like he can be like, do what I say. Fuck you.
Exactly. Exactly.
Now, interestingly, the Spire Arc, whose full name is Addison Jeremiah Magnus Albion, he mentions that the greater houses, including the Prime Minister Gwen's father, is kind of running that spire just fine. He doesn't really need to do much in that. So not only is Gwen a tiny-sized Murphy that's just like a hell to fight for, and she's also the Prime Minister's daughter, who's also in charge of growing all of the crystals for Spire Albion.
Now he would have political pull or be like, fuck you, do what I say, almost.
Right.
Yeah, at least in an open fashion. But I really want to know more about Gwen's mother, because this is becoming a pattern of like, main character's mother seems to know a lot and she's doing some weird suspicious things and we don't learn anything.
Wait, the mother's doing weird suspicious things?
Yeah, like in the first chapter, like Gwen is demanding she's going to go join the guard, and then her mother is so adamantly trying to stop her. And as soon as Gwen leaves, she's like, oh yeah, she just needed to get out of here. And also, the crystals are acting funny. What is that? What is she obviously doing? Because other people reference Gwen's mother as well.
Yeah, but Gwen's mother is very clearly, she was doing it so because it reflected Gwen's mother's own raising. Like, she did exactly the same thing, and they joked about it. She and Esterbrook joked about how there was actually more damage when Gwen's mother stormed out, right? So it was more of a coming of age thing. I don't sense anything nefarious out of that instance.
Not nefarious, but that Gwen's mother is doing things behind the scenes and we don't have access to it yet.
Maybe. And I mean, the whole crystals, you know, or talking or whatever just ties into whatever you said, you know, they're acting funny. That to me just ties back into the fact that things are changing and, you know, they're going to start to realize that some of the things they took for granted as technology really had, you know, the etherealists were right. They've got a soul or they've got, you know, a personality or whatever. So, I mean, come on, the books talked. So why is the crystals weird?
Well, the crystals were starting to act funny, which is different than like how they've been acting for centuries. That's significant, which we still don't know exactly what's happening there. But another family member of Gwen's is, as we've mentioned before, her cousin Benedict, who's actually Sorellan Lancaster instead of just Lancaster. Don't really know the connection there, but they are cousins, and he's a warrior born, which is a new thing.
Right. So I think it's like a lower house merged with one of the high houses, so they didn't quite take on the name.
It's like a Bannerman or something kind of like that, right? Like Game of Thrones. Like Kostark.
Yeah.
Right.
Yeah, so I think the term usually is cadet house, but I don't really know the connection yet.
Right, and then the fact that he's a warrior born is like another hit as well, which we don't fully know where they come from or why or anything. Presumably they come about from the normal process, but there's some they're a hybrid of some kind, and there's possibly multiple flavors of hybrids as well, because cats refer to them as half souls, and very often they seem to have some kind of affinity or connection with cats, so it's easy to assume they've got some kind of cat genetics going on there. But there are so many references to Sark being a silk weaver that, like, the first time I just thought they were like, no, really, Cavendish is behind the silk weavers. And they just Jim was just hitting you in the face with that over and over again. But there were just so many references that it was like, maybe there are different kinds of warrior born, which is another theory that I saw floated online when I was researching this episode, is that, you know, he might be part silk weaver, not part cat, you know, kind of like
Benedict.
I got
Benedict the impression specifically it was my part tiger, but that was just like my interpretation.
Feline something,
right?
But, yeah, I thought tiger. I don't know.
All of the warrior borns that we see have what they describe as feline slitted eyes. Even Sark, even though he doesn't act like a feline as much, but like, so they have higher metabolisms, and they desperately need to eat more. They will get very violent otherwise if they're starving. They're injured after they've been in a coma for 2 days. It's like, you need to leave them a bunch of food and then back away. They're faster, they have sharper senses, and sometimes they can do these weird leonine roars that Benedict does when he's really angry.
Right.
But we don't know exactly where the Warriorborns come from, if it's genetic and it pops up once in a while instead of it's like always there, or where they came from.
I'm surprised
at all
Benedict
in the first place.
Doesn't kill people like on a regular basis. Because like he's like starving himself.
He's a very calm person. No. Just manages to eat every time.
It's like Thomas. He starves himself to a point, but you know, he can unleash when he needs to. And then, sure, if you've been poisoned and haven't eaten for 2 days and you have this crazy high metabolism anyway, then that's when you see what it fully breaks down. But part of the whole properness and the Britishness and the tea and everything of these guys is that part of why that works so well here is that they live in spires and they're jammed together anyway. And so this level of politeness is what keeps the peace. They talk about that for the dueling and things like that. So Benedict's almost certainly got the same kind of rearing when he was a kid. He starves himself because he wants to fit in, not because he's trying to be a loose cannon or something, you know?
Yeah, so he doesn't like
a kid,
being
it's
different.
Because he wants to be accepted and fit in, and he just doesn't fit in.
Well, and being a warrior born specifically affects their status. They're not fully second-class citizens, but they do talk about the fact that, you know, he's not likely to win a mate in the sense that he's going to form a union. He's likely to get laid a bunch because women want to know what it's like, you know, because you hear the gossip and, you know, didn't you know warrior borns is 3 inches longer or whatever, you know? But that's kind of the inference. It's the inference that Gwen makes. And so she likes him well enough. And, you know, like there's almost a level of impropriety there because they kind of flirt with each other a little bit, I think. But she's like, look, he's a prize, but, you know, he's going to be held back by his status, his half warrior born. Or
I mean,
his
I interpreted that differently than you. I interpreted way more like brother sister, almost like making fun of each other, like that kind of relationship. There's, not flirting,
right? There's a fair bit there, and I mean, I'm not saying they don't flirt more with other people, because obviously Bridget thank you. So Bridget and them, they're all but hitched by the end of the book, right? And then, you know, but anyway, so there's just, there are other things going on.
It kind of seems like Benedict and great Gwen grew up together, because I don't think they have any other siblings. Gwen specifically mentions that she's the only child of the Lancaster house at the moment, and Benedict never mentions anyone else in his family. So they kind of like shove together and get more of the sibling relationship. And he'll just like, hey, you look really terrible today. Just kind of teasing.
Right.
I mean, Benedict does take a lot of effort on himself in order to stay calm, which is a fun thing that he's a wayist, which is one of the religions. It's very Buddhist-y sounding.
Very Buddhist, monkish, monk.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. It will kind of go into that a little bit more when you talk about religions, but like it's a thing that he did kind of a couple years ago, and he's a little different now. And so he mentions things that, or he swears by things that Gwen doesn't. But yeah, then there's Bridget, and Bridget's interesting in the fact that she's apparently really tall for a woman, really strong, and she talks to cats.
Right.
Just let that hang there. She talks to cats. And they talk back at her.
And it's awesome.
Yeah, but so does Albion, by the way. So, because Albion has a cat name.
Oh, yeah,
he does. The Spire Arc. So,
he's
Long Thinker. He's Long Thinker.
Yeah, and Bridget's father is Word Keeper. Yeah.
Yeah.
Because Bridget's true name, as the mouse Raoul calls it, is Little Mouse. Mm-hmm. Because she was supposed to be a lot smaller. And then she became taller than every other woman in the Spire.
Right. And I guess while we're talking about cat names, Grimm also gets one by the end. He's Grimm Shiptrees.
Yeah, because so. Raoul really liked the Shiptree, a.k.a. a mast.
But then that's an indication that you don't need to be able to talk to cats to have a cat name, though. Like, Grimm doesn't talk to cats.
He talks to the cats.
Not yet.
He just can't understand when they talk back.
Well, he doesn't understand.
Right.
He doesn't speak cat.
Wasn't he the one that was talking about taking lessons or something like that, too? So, somebody was like, if I'm going to hang around cats, I might as well learn the language.
That might have been him, considering he was willing to pick it up. But, Bridget, when I first read the book, in the first chapter that introduced her, when she was all small and scared and she didn't want to go out and join the guardsmen, I thought she was like 12. But no, she's 17. So it was kind of like a weird, jarring moment when it got to the end of that chapter. I don't know. Other than the fact that she didn't want to leave home, she doesn't really have any issues with confidence. She actually caused a lot of trouble because she's willing to talk more than she should have, which had the whole duel with the Asters.
She doesn't like when people talk shit about her family or their business.
Yeah. And then that kind of is what gets her involved with Gwen and Benedict, because they're going to help her. But I thought it was fun and sometimes annoying that Gwen involved herself with Bridget's issue because Gwen figured she has to help this poor girl that talks to cats, because otherwise Bridget wouldn't be able to get herself out of it, right? Well, Gwen kind of made it more of a problem because then Reggie Astor didn't want to back down in front of Gwen. And she continually involves herself in things, and Bridget keeps saying, please stop trying to help me.
She's a bit of a busybody. She's very much one of those characters where it's like, the way I think we should solve this is definitely the right way, and we are going to do that.
Yeah, she...
Well, and she always takes things to your face, whether it's gauntlet blasts or paperwork and the threat of treason, you know, so...
Yeah, Gwen, she does feel like the responsibility of her position in general ability to help other people, but she doesn't realize that other people are capable of helping themselves as well. And that's when her blindness in that way is very condescending, but it comes to a head with Bridget, because Bridget points out to her that I can do it myself, get away. And then whatever. But they're friends by the end, and they never really had a problem in the beginning anyway. I don't want to talk it up like that. But Bridget's other best friend is Raoul, the main cat of the story, whose arrogance I did find annoying.
You misspoke main character.
Yeah. Of course, he's the most important thing in person, and all the humans just serve him.
I enjoy the cat perspective, but it's honestly not my favorite part, which I think it's a lot of people's favorite part, but... But it's cool.
No, I found it annoying because a level of pragmatism and realism kind of just makes it all really stupid. But it's just the overwhelming arrogance all the time got grating.
Have you guys I do like Raoul as a fucking character. Cat?
Yes.
Yeah, I have a cat. He's not arrogant. He's sleepy.
Oh, he's so sweet. He's so cute. I love your cat.
I think you're just not paying attention. So... You're the thing that annoyingly occupies his home, not the other way around. Maybe come see our cat, and then it would click for you instantly. You would be like, oh yeah, that's fucking Raoul right there, so little bastard.
I mean, I get the cat arrogance, but the way that one of the other cats, Meryl, said, humans can't speak proper language. It's they can't speak in animal sounds. Gee, I wonder why. And it's just like the weird condescension that they have and they throw around. It's like, it gets a little grating at that point instead of just being the, of course I own you. Like, that would have been better if it just stayed at that.
Well, but yeah, Raoul is tempered in a way because he begrudgingly admits that Little Mouse has a purpose, right? You know, and he adapts more to society, whereas the other cats, like, they live in these dark holes and then they think it's like the height of civilization, you know, kind of like really, when the nine really claws were
Little Mouse, like, he's straight up, nobody gonna fuck with her.
Right.
Yeah.
Well, he ran into a burning building, which is the height of insanity because she did.
Yeah. And the entire time he's thinking, so how dare she do that? Because if she's gone, who's going to scratch my ears? Right. But it was very obvious that he does love her. It's just like the way that he frames it. I actually thought that part was funny instead of annoying.
Yeah. Felt very much like a justification. I'm not going to admit I love her. Mm-hmm. Who's going to scratch my ears?
Right, because he only does things that he wants to do. He never gets manipulated into doing things.
Oh, never.
Mm-hmm. But other characters who understand him, even though I don't think they should, are the Ethrealists, like Ferris and Folly. And these characters, I'm surprised that I liked them so much, because with the way that they have these little insanities, it takes a lot of skill in order to write that kind of character effectively and still be entertaining. And Jim did it.
I mean, I liked Ferris so much that in my D&D campaign, there's a crazy wizard called Ferris. It's very much like him.
I started playing a mystic in 5th edition, which is the psionic class for the Unearthed Arcana playtesting, if you haven't done that. He is pretty heavily modeled off of Master Ferris, including the doorknobs are hard. So yeah, like that sort of quirkiness. Like the first time that I did it, I was like, hold on, does this door have a doorknob? And they're like, yeah. And I'm like, okay, can someone get this for me? They look at me and they're like, what? And I'm like, what? Doorknobs are hard. Okay, forget about it.
Blasted things.
Yeah, so just the look that, like, these 20-year veteran players, like, all look at me and they're like, what the hell did you just say? So Ferris is actually, I think he's my favorite character. Like, tons of my friends loved Raoul, but I always identify with the wizardy types. Like, I love their quirks and I love the fact that they seem to know what's going on and no one else does.
I really like Ferris. Yeah. Also.
Ferris and Folly are definitely some of my favorites.
Yeah. In the whole scene when the Aurorans burst into his house and he's like, please don't do that, there's too much pain down that path, and then obliterates them, you know, just like giblets everywhere. I was like, yeah, that's a wizard right there. That's why he's old. You don't mess with the old guy.
Yeah, just like characters like that are hard in order to write correctly and make all of those weird insanities make sense when you look back at it, sort of. Like when he saves Captain Grimm from probably definitely a Silkweaver attack and with the venom and everything. It's like, have we met? And Ferris says, no, we meet tomorrow. Excuse me? And then they did meet tomorrow. And it made sense. And it
Just, he's like, told you we'd meet tomorrow.
Yeah. And also, like, Ferris, like, as he's coming in to examine him, he's like, do you mind if I examine you? And Grimm says, okay. And Ferris leaves the room and looks at him through the wall. And that's how he can actually assess him. Because he can't look at it directly for some reason. We haven't really got an explanation as to how, but they're just really weird. And every time he has to open a doorknob, he just like slaps at it and then he asks someone for help because he just can't figure out how to do it.
My headcanon for the examination is that he was looking at his etheric energy and maybe the physical details would have distracted him by being able to see, you know, Grimm's skin and clothing and whatever freaked him out. But
we also do get the whole crazy when we get the point of view from what's her name?
Cavendish.
Folly, yeah. We'll get there from Folly. We learn that, I mean, they appear crazy, but from their point of view, it makes sense. Like,
but specifically that etheric energy and the manipulations thereof have a toll, and part of that toll is pieces are missing, whether that's just personality or literally pieces of their brain. That's why they have their fetishes or their wagons full of artifacts and stuff. And Folly talks to the burnt, spent out lumen crystals.
Oh yeah, there's definitely some craziness, but mostly like a lot of the stuff they do, when you get it from their point of view, it makes sense. And then there are the little quirks, sure, but a lot of the stuff that happens is when you get it from the other point of view, like, it's legit. Like, for example, no, we meet tomorrow because he has, like, foresight. He knows they meet tomorrow.
Right.
Right. Yeah, I mean, with Folly and her appearance, she's 16, 17 like the rest of them, and she has red and white dyed hair, which when she braids it, it looks like candy stripes, which is very interesting. She also has matching eyes. She wears her clothing in really weird ways. The way the description is of it feels right, but she tied a bunch of scarves on her arms. She wore a bunch of mismatching clothes, had bandolier pistols in which she put a bag of lumen crystals.
Which and is basically a weapon for her.
Yeah, right. But that's also, she can only talk to a crystal or another etherealist directly. She cannot talk to Bridget directly. She has to say, well, Bridget should know this, and Bridget should know that, and Bridget's really interesting, but I cannot talk directly to Bridget. And so she has to talk
that's
to
one of those
the
quirks
crystals.
Where she's, where it's just you know, crazy, weird.
So when Folly and Bridget get kidnapped
really,
by bad guys...
It isn't established why or she can't speak to Bridget or anything.
Yeah. But when Bridget and Folly get kidnapped by bad guys and they take away the crystals, she's lost. As she describes it, she was falling and can't right herself otherwise. And so Bridget found a lumen crystal she had in her pocket, said, it's no longer mine, and gave it to her. And all of a sudden, she could talk again. She could function. And
it also specifically has to be an owned, lost lumen crystal. It can't just be one she's handed, as Bridget says, it's no longer mine.
Mm-hmm.
Because apparently, like, yeah, she can't just give her one. That's
yeah, it can't
also
just be, like, let you borrow it. It has to be, like, Folly's now. And these
yeah, but
little
specifically,
insanities...
It has to be lost. It can't be, like, here, I have this. I will give it to you. Here you go.
Folly does seem to claim
them, work.
So...
Yeah, but it seems to be more like, you know, they're discarded, not given.
Maybe.
That's what I remember, anyway. That it has to be discarded, not given. For like that's Folly's rule.
I don't know.
Which is also
maybe
why Bridget does the. Which is why Bridget does the. It's no longer mine. It's discarded.
But that's the same thing with a gift, right? Like if you give something to someone, it's no longer yours.
No, because then it's not been discarded. Like there's
the
definition
thing, like,
difference.
We don't know if the definition, like the requirement for Folly, is if it was actually discarded versus if it was just not someone else's.
I mean, it's made. I think it's done in such a deliberate way that I feel like it's. I don't know if it's like meant to tell us that, you know. I don't even know if it's important, but it's basically it can't be a gift. It can't be here. You take this; it's now yours.
I
it has to be a lost crystal, one that's been discarded.
But I thought that's exactly what Bridget did when they were stuck in the. They were captured, so they were captured by Sark and the Marines at one point.
Well, not Sark. But the Marines,
well,
the Auroran Marines.
Okay, sure, right. Because it was Aspira or whoever was checking on them. But she just, they didn't take her lumen crystal, so she had a spare and gave it to Folly, and that's when you get the whole, like, she was falling and the explanation. I don't remember the exact dialogue on whether it was given or whatever, but I'm pretty sure she didn't, quote-unquote, discard it. But she did talk about being lost and alone and whatever, and that mm-hmm. started to put her back together.
Yeah, and these insanities build up. So she would find things for Ferris and all these little things that he had actually was like two wagon loads of stuff that he needed to have in order to function. So when the bad guy etherealist, Sycorax Cavendish, which we'll talk about in a minute, she decides like as a ransom, essentially, to take those away from him so he can no longer function. And so then, of course, they had to go get him back. But it's just two wagon loads of things. And once it's gone, he's bowled over in pain. He says, like, I need these things. I need two left slippers and a ton of bricks and a bunch of book papers and stuff. It's just random little crap, but like it's something about it is he needs it to function, to fill a hole, as Holly describes it, Folly.
Right.
But Ferris, who's fairly old, did have a previous apprentice, which was Sycorax, who now apparently takes the name Cavendish, and he calls her Cora. But the name Sycorax is really strange because it comes from Shakespeare. It's the name of the witch that gave birth to Caliban in the play The Tempest. Just all around, bad person, bad name. And that's hers. So, I don't think she chose that one. I kind of think that's just like her given name based on the way that he said that, oh, she's calling herself Cavendish now. So she probably throws away last names all the time. But she's very vile and very mean. She focuses so highly on politeness and manners that if any time you do something a little bit wrong, she'll torture you. And she loves that part. But she's stuck with manners, the way that Folly is stuck with her lumen crystals and has to talk to them.
I get that there's like a... Well, it's just like my thought on it. That like the reason that's her insanity is because she is such a vile and evil person on the inside, that her insanity manifests with this properness and etiquette.
Maybe. It does. It sounds kind of like justification. Like, there's no real connection, but she feels a lot like a fairy. You know?
Kinda, I guess, yeah.
No, and in fact, that's an important thing that just sparked my memory. So, I forget who it was. I just wrote down the words, but basically, I think Grimm talks about when he sees Cavendish that she had hungry fae sparks in her eyes or something like that. So specifically use the word fae with her, which I thought was interesting because when we're trying to link this to worlds and whatnot, you get the back and forth between the Codex Alera references, which we haven't brought up so far, but Ferris says, you know, about somebody that they're possessed with a certain amount of fury, which we've talked about is... Before the show, anyway, we talked about that's either a direct reference to history or some people online theorize that has to do with the Codex Alera. But the fact that he references Fae and we've got other references to horses and whatnot kind of anchors it to at least our world, if not partially to the Dresden Files world, potentially. So I thought that was kind of interesting.
And does it reference
Brandon
Shakespeare?
Sanders universe confirmed Jim Butcher style?
Well, and I think he said that, right? Didn't you say that he says that it probably is, but he's not going to tell you what because it's more fun that way? Wasn't that what you mentioned?
Okay. When he came on episode 17, I deliberately asked him, is Sender Spires a slant world? Is it connected to anything else that he's written? As do they share universes in some fashion like the Cosmere of Brandon Sanderson's? And he said, I'm pretty sure I'm not going to tell you because it's more fun that way. In my mind, that means yes, but he didn't say it.
Right. And we don't know to what extent, and we don't know how, and it's very clearly a far distant future world of some kind, because the builders were there and now they're not, you know, mm-hmm. and so forth and so on. So there's 100 clues on this being, you know, there probably was some civilization and how the world came about and fell, and I've got my own headcanons and whatnot, but... but yeah, so slant world, though, what's your working definition for that?
Well, my definition is things that, like, just a bunch of different series of books that are connected through world or universe, but the plot lines aren't connected. So, okay. Like, Mistborn is not connected to Warbreaker, if you know Brandon Sanderson stuff, except for the fact that they are in the same universe, they have similar structure.
The same rules, right?
Similar structure for the magic system, and there's one character who travels between them for some reason. I don't know why. Okay. That character's weird.
But spoiler alert for everyone else. Which character is that? Because I read Mistborn, but I haven't read the others.
Hoid. He shows up in Mistborn, and he shows up in Warbreaker for like a minute, ooh, and you actually mostly see that as a reference because in the Stormlight Archive, he mentions he went to Warbreaker world. And in Stormlight Archive, he's Wit. He's the King's Wit.
Who is he in Mistborn?
He's just a guy that kind of shows up and starts helping Vin for like 10 minutes in book three or something. Book two.
I don't remember.
Right.
Okay. Yeah. Okay. Small character.
So,
he's really
so
weird.
Your theory is that these all exist in the same universe somewhere but aren't actually directly related.
I mean, okay. My personal headcanon is this is future Codex Alera.
And from
I actually
some
had
the
a different spin on that, but you know it's clearly indicated that it's a future thing. But what if it's like a trick? It's a future thing, but actually, the people who goes to the Codex Alera world are the people here in this world. So it's
except
like before Codex Alera.
We almost all but know that's not the case because he specifically says that the inspiration for Codex Alera is the Lost Roman Legion meets Pokemon. And so,
but he could have like I mean, there's nothing tied it down. You could, like, change it.
Yeah, sure. But yeah, I think that's less likely. I think it's, you know, the far future for some reason. The builders thing, I mean, it's sourced out of 100 different kinds of fantasy and sci-fi, so I don't know the full extent he's going to take it. Personally, reading it the first time, I was thinking it was very, very heavily influenced by StarCraft. And reading it the second time, I saw some Diablo references as well, where it's like, let's worry about the archangels and them possibly being a literal thing. So we might, like, it's either the archangels, quote unquote, are, you know, Clark's third law, right? Sufficiently advanced technology is indistinguishable from magic. So maybe they're up in the heavens, quote unquote, they're in high orbit or something. And then whatever the enemy is clearly stuck on the surface. But the surface thing in the mists obviously clues me into The Mist from Stephen King, which is like one of my favorite, you know, modern horror type stories anyway. And it's like, so is the mist, is it weaponized because it attacks steel? Is it, you know, cover for all the creatures like mist moths and whatever else live out in the mist, like silk weavers? Because if this is one of those worlds, none of those creatures existed there, not natively. So they'd be transplants or they'd be an invasive species or something. So there's 100 things that aren't answered that hopefully we get more clues in the next book. And I imagine we will.
I hope so. But
right.
Yeah. I don't know. It's like, man, we don't fucking know. But
we need another book after Peace Talks. Go. Woo.
Yeah. I mean, really, Jim. Get to the rock. Can I tie him down somewhere and just be like, work, monkey, work?
Do you want to come out to Salt Lake for September 21st? Because he's going to be here. Just saying.
If you're going to buy me airfare, I'll think about it.
P.S. This is totally not a collaboration. This isn't conspiracy to kidnap Jim Butcher. This is entrapment. So, yeah. Just so you know whose side I'm on. But anyway.
Let's continue on with the characters, because I, for one, really enjoyed the crew of the Predator as much as any of the other characters. Like, there's Kettle and Journeyman and Stern and a little bit of Dr. Baggin, more in the fact that there's just really funny moment when Ferris is working on some venom-bitten people, and he walks out of the infirmary room, and the doctor's about to follow him out, but he slams the door in his face and stares at it so he can look at the other people. It's just a hilarious little moment right there.
But apparently I missed that both times because I don't remember that. That's awesome.
Yeah, it was fun. But there was another character who's not really part of Predator, but she was, and her name is Captain Calliope Ransom. I think it's Calliope because it sounds and looks really Greek, but I could be pronouncing it wrong. She
I don't like her.
Was also the captain, and still is, the captain of Mist Shark. And as she shows up, everyone's like pointing guns at her, and they're really like specific. They're hiding all of their valuables so she can't steal them.
Man, she's like a backstabbing bitch.
Yeah, she's
she's her introduction. Is it Sapphire from Firefly? So anyway,
I don't know because I've never watched Firefly. But
you need to get over your Joss Whedon hating wrongness.
I just haven't gotten around to it. But
whatever.
Everyone's
excuse.
Really on edge
and
when
Sapphire
she shows up.
Sapphire is a very good description of who she is.
Right.
But as Ransom leaves, Grimm says, or she's going into another room, Grimm says, like, that woman drives me crazy. And Kettle, the pilot of Predator, says, why'd you marry her then?
Right. There's a similar moment later in the book, too, I think, where she's griping about Grimm, and then they're like, well, why'd you marry him then?
No, it was a little different of the okay. Auroran Marine, the major. He was like, god damn, that guy's a problem. It's like, yeah, you weren't even married to him.
Oh, right. Yeah.
And, yeah, she's kind of fun in the fact that she causes a lot of trouble. She's like trouble incarnate, but she's a fully fleshed character, and I really enjoyed that. Like, the reason that as she was shooting at all of the shipping landyards at Habel Landing was the fact that she shot last at Predator because Predator was once her home, and she just couldn't do it first. And Predator survived, which was her downfall, but I don't know, she's like a very real character.
That's part of more of the story that I want to get out of the Olympian affair, because the Mist Shark is the fastest ship in the skies because of a race between Predator and Mist Shark.
They fucking cheated.
Okay, Kettle, settle down.
Kettle, by the way, is also an awesome character.
Oh yeah, I love him, and I love Journeyman, because Journeyman is very clearly like the engineer's engineer, you know.
Mm-hmm.
So there's a lot of tie in there too, but yeah. So yes, they cheated, but you know it happened. It was like an Olympian race. So with this whole the Olympian affair and stuff like that, there's a lot of backstory I think that has the potential to get filled in. If it's so much as Gwen's on the bridge of the ship and asking Grimm questions the whole time they're flying out there, for all I care, that could be the entire book, but I know it's not going to be. So
yeah. So what actually happened during that race was Shark cheated by putting things in the Hazlitt cage that goes around the crystal in order to make it work, and the heat of the crystal charred it, which made sure that the connections were faulty, and if they ran it too hard, it'd break apart the ship, essentially. So they had to cut down by 10-15% of maximum in order to not get killed. And just because Grimm was suspicious, he got Mr. Stern to take some stew that Grimm almost cooked, because he's terrible at cooking, and put it on
purpose.
That was fun.
Yeah.
We'll get to that in a minute. And Stern put it
on for morale,
their Hazlitt cage and did the same thing at the end. Just was like, I know you're up to no good. I just have to fuck with you because you're going to cause problems. And it was just, that's how we got the kind of story from that. But Journeyman, as he had all these crystals, which he deliberately just said, I love you. I want you to marry me and bear my children, as this giant crystal gets delivered to him. Oh, he's such an engineer. He's like exactly like Scotty, but times 10.
Right. And way less professionalism, let's just be clear.
Oh, yeah. So. And he loves the crystals and he loves working on the crystals, but to the point that when he was in charge of people's shifts, he basically made it so that there was no cook on board. So kind of because it was an oversight on Grimm's part, he and his XO started making dinner. And they did it so badly that everyone was kind of like stuck with it. And also, he just gave a bowl of it to Kettle and says, go make sure Journeyman eats his fill, because it's his fault.
Right.
But also, he had to cook badly because they can't be wanting the captain to be cooking. He's got to do captain-y things.
Right. And it needed to be a little bit of punishment still all the way around and make sure the message was sent, you know? Mm-hmm. Like, that's part of why I love the interaction between Kettle, because I see Kettle more as his XO than anything, you know, because he doesn't talk to Creedy half as much as he talks to Kettle, I mean, and Kettle and them are friends.
One of the other guys surely must be the XO when XO is not around. He's pretty new to the ship. Who was XO before? Probably Kettle?
No, Kettle's got his position.
Kettle's the pilot, so... Yeah, exactly. He'd be busy flying the ship. Otherwise, I would say that. But certainly, you know, off ship, Kettle is definitely more buddy-buddy with Grimm.
Yeah, they work together very well. But Creedy, his job as the executive officer, if you didn't know what XO means, is he's running the ship where Grimm can't. So that's why Creedy is in charge of the guns at the end of the fight. And Grimm is talking to Kettle's like, you move this way, you move that way, and this is how you save my ship.
Well, I waited the Kettle, whole he left book. Kettle the hell alone for that.
A little bit.
I waited the whole book for him to call him number two.
Right.
And didn't happen.
I waited the whole book for him to call Kettle, or call Creedy a green-blooded hobgoblin, but, you know, just do what you can. So, sorry, too deep of a reference for you guys?
Yeah, too deep for me.
So, there's one character remaining, and that's actually Predator herself. That was just very strange. When Folly gets aboard Predator for the second time or something like that, and Predator's like all up and running, all the crystals are going, and they're going to go to war, Folly can talk to the ship. And the ship is a woman and talks back. And it's hard to differentiate where is the soul of this ship and how much is it the ship doing something versus people working the ship as they're supposed to.
I don't know. I do think that it's not so much the ship as the old power crystal, special one they have. That's like the soul, and that's like where the entity's mind resides. Like if you took that crystal out of the ship, I think that that's where the consciousness would be.
I don't know, because they mentioned specifically you can't just treat ships like transport, because if you just treat it as a mechanical thing, they won't work as well. But Grimm treats Predator like its own entity, whether or not he realized it is its own entity, and therefore she works better for him.
It's presumably Predator, the ship, has always had that crystal, but I think the entity had intelligence and awareness before it was placed in the ship.
And there's just a lot we don't understand. It's like the whole...
it's all guesswork, right? That's just what I...
Where does the whole technology come from in the first place? And when the builders presumably built crystals for their purposes, did it still take generations to do it or not? You know, like, there are so many questions in this book just because it is the first and only of its series right now. But yeah, especially around the crystals. I mean, I think we were talking before the show, right? Or I guess we were talking about Mommy being up to no good, Mommy Lancaster. And it's like, well, if the crystals are behaving strangely, I mean, does that mean they're literally behaving strangely? Or does that mean they're just doing something they haven't seen before?
Well, Gwen treats the crystals as just things. She knows how to work them in a very scientific manner with lots of calculations. So when she starts helping Journeyman and doing things differently, he's all upset, and it's so much funnier. But
that's kind of the difference between a manufacturer and an engineer, like out in the field anyway, is that was that clash to me, because it's like, you know, we make the instruction manual for a purpose. Whereas he's very much, I mean, he does it by feel, but not necessarily to the level that Folly does, right? He anthropomorphizes
yes.
Predator, but not necessarily literally believes that Predator is going to talk to him back, right?
No.
We're talking like the Scotty level of feel the ship versus like Folly talk to an actual entity on the other side, you know?
Yeah.
And that's a pretty thin line, but
it's just like, so the ship Predator is clearly aware of its people, and her connection to Grimm seems pretty obvious, but Grimm doesn't seem aware that the ship is sentient in any way.
Right.
But it is kind of reminding me of a specific thing that happened Codex Alera, in which there was a ship captain, I think a merchant or smuggler again, that his fury was the ship. He had a wood fury, and he just made it a ship. And that's why he was able to work it better than any other ship could do. Because sometimes...
Oh, that's pretty cool.
Yeah, and if he wanted to, he could just have the planks of the ship, like, wrap around you if he wanted to. You have to stay fucking right there. And things like that. So he was obviously aware of the ship as being a fury and connected to him, and Grimm isn't. But his ship is alive. And the fuck does that mean?
Right.
We'll find out in 4 books or something.
It means that they need an etherealist on deck because they can make it way more badass.
Like, oh yeah, like
being able
like
to shoot
point
out
exactly
like that.
Where the thing they're chasing is.
Right. Mm-hmm. Yeah. So, yeah. Suddenly, being able to paint a target on your shroud—I mean, that takes you hundreds of years in the future as far as combat capabilities. To be like, oh, cool, we can track targets now. Just shoot the cannons over there. Mm-hmm. So
yeah, don't even have to go out of the mist. Just stay here, shoot that way.
Right.
All right. So we discussed the characters, not even all of them, in one book, and we're at over an hour. So I think we're going to have to break this up into a part 2, and we'll see about a part 3.
As is tradition.
Right?
Right. So, the Justin Files discuss Cinder Spires will continue eventually. And for now, got to plug all the rest of our stuff, so you guys got to help me out.
Well, you can start with the podcast you're on. Every link to every podcast.
Yeah,
go look there.
So I'm doing High Fantasy, and next week I get to talk to Daniel Wilson, the PhD in robotics guy who wrote Robopocalypse, and his new book called The Clockwork Dynasty is coming out on August 1st, and that's when that episode will be released. So I get to talk to him before you guys get to hear it. Sorry. And we're probably also going to be doing another episode that releases next week as well, just so you're not, like, stuck. And so we've got Great Scott with Jacob and J-Ray. I don't know where they are. Somewhere in season 5, I think, in The Office. We have a new podcast called The Long Haul about families and gaming. That's fun, I'm sure. Do we have any others?
Probably. Probably do. Broken Jaws spells XYZ, you'll be able to find all our podcasts.
Yep. And also, we have a Patreon if you want to get a sticker or anything else. We have other rewards.
So. Yeah, Patreon.
Wait, am I supposed to charge for money. Those stickers?
Well,
I mean, go to Patreon to support us. Justin's kids got to eat.
If you go to Salt Lake City Comic Con and track down Justin as his Verminositor getup, probably, you'll be able to get a sticker because he'll take them there and he'll have them. Right?
Awesome. Then you can get them for free. Uh-huh. Huh. You'll just have to fly out to Salt Lake City to do it.
Exactly. So I think this is the end and all our stuff, but please give us money and goodbye.
Money, please. Bye-bye.